Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining Sober Indians Wednesday Night Live. I'm Karen, your host, and tonight we have Joseph, and he's going to take us down his road to recovery. Thank you for joining us tonight, Joseph. How are you doing?
I'm well, Karen. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. So why don't we start out with you telling everybody a little bit about yourself, and then we can go into your recovery, from addiction to recovery.
My name is Joseph Gideon Gravel. I am from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. I am part of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. I have lived up here most of my life, spent some time in Colorado, spent some time down in the Southwest in Texas. Been back around here for a little while, putting the pieces back together. Got just over 3 years of recovery. I believe it was three years, December 6th. 2020 is my 3 year mark. But yeah, just, boxer. My main hobby right now is boxing. I've been out of work for a few months because of the whole pandemic we got going on. So if you haven't heard of that yet, got a lot of free time on my hands, and which in the past used to be a kind of a bad thing for me, but now I've got plenty of things to fill my time, and I like it.
Good. That sounds good. What started you into kind of that downward spiral into addiction?
Mainly, I would say the root of it was for me, would have been this, like, the curious kid, the case of the curious kid. Like, most people my age, my generation, that have fallen victim to addiction could attribute it to that. And but what really kicked in the burners was sports injuries and doctors overprescribing me. And at the time, I didn't know that. I just never paid attention to the literature, paid attention to the signs that the drugs that I had been given were actually pain drug. I didn't know what they were. In my mind, it was like a Tylenol or like an ibuprofen or something. But I was prescribed pretty heavy painkillers at a fairly young age of like 16, 17. And being as outgoing as I am, I'm pretty prone to injuries, especially at that time in my life. I felt like I was some kind of significant injury every few months. And then it was a injury in wrestling. I blew my knee out in wrestling, and that's what started it. And then shortly after that, I cut my leg really bad. Being a foolish kid, sliding down a handrail, a banister, sliding down on a piece of metal sticking out, and it cut me from almost my knee to my hip. And I ended up having to get 14 stitches on the inside of my leg and 25 staples on the outside to hold it together. And this was right almost not even a month after the knee injury. So the doctor just kind of doubled down on me. And I'd never really took the medication. It's kind of side to the side. And I didn't realize what it was until shortly thereafter. And then hanging out with certain friends at the time, and then they're talking about it. I'm like, oh yeah, those are fun, you know, you can take those and you can get high, blah, blah, blah. And so I just kind of started my curiosity. And then there was a good chunk of sobriety after that. But like at the time, I didn't realize what it was I was taking or that I was doing. I was just a young kid in a party phase. And my main thing at the time was, you know, going out and drinking with my friends. And then shortly thereafter, I fell at work and I hurt my same knee really, really bad again. I fell getting out of one of the work trucks and hit it directly on the cement. And one of the guys I worked with, seeing how much pain I was in, he's like, hey, man, calm down. Here, take one of these. And gave me a methadone. And then after that, it was pretty much like, I was like, oh, yeah, this good feeling. And then after that, it was pretty much downhill for quite a few years. And then that's pretty much where I got started.
Oh, wow. So I was wondering if maybe when you were talking, if peer pressure might have been a factor at some point in that. So it kind of sounds like, in a way, it was to a degree.
It was, but at the same time, as much as like I wasn't too much of a follower, but I was like, they wouldn't have had, like, there was no one really that could have pressured me into doing something that I really didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it was more they provided an avenue, a really bad avenue for me. But, yeah, there's really nobody that can pressure me into doing something that I don't want to do. I'm admittedly pretty hard-headed when it comes to stuff that I don't agree with.
Mm. That makes sense, and that's a good thing. At what point did you realize that you had a problem with it and needed to do something about it?
I want to say it was about the age of 20 after I had already spent, because I had worked. My dad had instilled in me about, like, working hard for what you want and start working. And, like, he had me working at a young age. And they had me get my first job, actual legal job, which wasn't just, like, helping out family on the farm or helping my dad do construction on the side. It was actually, like, workforce at 14 years old. And like, by the time I was 19, I had already had a pretty decent bank account. I had really good credit score. I'd already owned, like, my own dirt bike, had my own vehicle, my own snowmobile that I all bought and paid for myself. And then there was, at one point, I was just realized, I was like, wow, I went from that, this person that was making these payments, that, you know, I was living on my own. I'd moved to a different part of the state to go to school and then dropped out of school. And then it was right around that time I was like, I didn't realize it till it just clicked one day. And I was like, I am just one of those people that is spending all of his money on drugs now. But at that time I was still working enough and doing everything that I could pay my stuff. And then I would just, the rest of my money would just go to my addiction or partying or nothing solid, nothing with any solidarity to it.
Oh, wow. Was there a breaking point for you?
There was a lot that built up. There was, my dad worked, there's a bridge up here in our hometown, that takes you from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan to Sault Ste. Marie, Canada. And the summer I turned 19, I worked, my dad was he was chief of maintenance up there. And I worked under him for the summer. And that summer I was kind of like dabbling in and out of drugs. I wasn't really messing up my work life or anything. It was more experimenting. And, but as towards the end of that summer is when I started taking the next step, where it was into harder drugs and harder means of using drugs. It wasn't just like a weekend thing anymore. And then that next summer I worked for him again, and it was much worse, and it was now affecting my work and everything. I had a job all winter, and it would have started affecting that job. And then I worked that summer out, and then the third summer I went to go back and work, I failed the drug test. And it just kind of – it cut me pretty deep, seeing that, you know, like, I know how much my dad respects his job and how much he respects – you know, being the working man and this and that. And he even enjoyed having his son working for him. And I couldn't even you know, straighten up long enough to pass a drug test to get that job again. It was actually a really good job. And then another thing, too, was I was so – one of my really good friends passed away when I was about 20. The winter I turned 21, and I couldn't sober up long enough to even make it to his memorial service. I was so hungover and so dope sick that I couldn't even, you know, go say my final goodbyes to him. And, like, I went off the radar for, like, a month around that time. And – then just from there, just the moving around, that's when like the really big lie started. I couldn't hold the job, couldn't find a job. My vehicle started deteriorating. My health started deteriorating. I was skinny. When I wasn't on drugs, I'm a bigger guy. I'm like, my natural weight right now is like 230 pounds. Back then I was 160 pounds. And that was just like significantly small for me. And then I would sober up for a short chunk of time and immediately put like 30, 40 pounds on. So people started realizing that like the routine or they started realizing the changes around me. And that's when I quit hanging out around people that would notice those things. And I just kind of either stayed in my cave or hung around people that were only benefiting my addiction. And then stole from my parents. And I had just come up with excuses to why I had done it. Woke up in the hospital a couple times with no answers. The one time I just woke up and locked myself out of there and they were looking for me for a little bit. And then the next time I was trying to quit cold turkey and it was just too much for me at the time. And I took some kind of drug. I can't remember exactly what it was. It was so long ago. It was 10 years ago almost now. I took some kind of drug and I took way too much of it. And it sent me into like almost like a seizure. And I was also going through with like severe, I was 100% into full blown withdrawal at the time as well. And I was having like almost like a walking seizure, I guess you could call it. Like I couldn't, like my body was like jolting. I kept seeing flashes of light. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't do anything. So then I had to put myself in the hospital and they classified it as an overdose and then had to like pump my system. And then, that was, I want to say I was about 22 when that happened. And that's when I moved out of where I was living, stayed at my parents' house for a couple of weeks, and I tried doing the sober thing on my own, which just didn't work. And right as soon as I felt better and I could start walking again, I pretty much was back on the street doing the same thing. But I was even more secretive about it this time. I was running around under the radar, buying drugs, selling drugs, just to support my habit. And I had racked up a couple charges that I didn't know about. And like at the time, I would get like a driving on suspended license or I would get charges like that. So I never had got anything ever really related to substance abuse, my charges, and I would always skate by. I'd always skate under the radar. And then I ended up made the choice that winter. I believe it was the winter of the fall of 2013. I made the choice to put myself in rehab. And the only people that really knew about it up until the day I was leaving was my mom and dad at the time and my counselor. I was about a week out of the rehab and I just went, up to our local tribal health center and got a counselor. And then our first meeting, I was like, I need to go to rehab. And they're like, well, that's a really big step. Most people, you know, we got to pry that out of them. I was like, I need to get out of here. It's not, you know, it's death or jail for me right now. And then a couple of days beforehand, I told my parents what I was doing. I mean, it wasn't like I had to tie up any loose ends. I wasn't working at the time. I was living off of like old unemployment checks that I hadn't had the chance to spend yet because I was, you know, laid up. And then I went to the rehab and then got out of there, and I stayed sober for a little while after that. It was a good chunk considering the circumstances, but the first day I had got out of rehab, moved back into my trailer with my cousin, and my cousin is actually one of the people that is like one of the pillars of my sobriety. He's like one of the guys that's no matter what I've done, he's always will be in my corner, and he'll forever be in my corner no matter what happens. He's one of the fighters that I have. And him and I were staying up there, and I had just got out of the shower, and two detectives came to my door, and their first words were, "Well, where have you been for the last 6 weeks?" And I was like, "I was in rehab." Well, come to find out, I didn't find out till a lot later that they were investigating me for over a year because of the drug activity that was going on in the area up here. And I was in and out of a lot of their radars because I was, like I said, I was going out and getting drugs and getting just enough to sell them to support my own habit. And but in that time, I had racked up a couple charges that I didn't know about that they were hanging over my head. And they talked to me that day. They asked me all these questions, and I just, you know, gave them the business. I said, "Hey, man, I'm clean. I'm sober. You guys are asking me to go buy drugs for you right now, and I just got out of rehab. I'm like, you guys can take that to the store, man. I don't want nothing to do with it." They didn't like to hear that. They were thinking they were going to use a scare tactic on me, but like I said, I'm pretty hard-headed. And so I just brushed that off. I think I figured maybe that was just, you know, like that was like their Hail Mary. And about 6 months later, they come again and they start doing the same thing, the same spiel they had. And I told them the same thing. I was like, "Listen, guys, I'm sober, blah, blah, blah." Well, then this started happening like once a week. They started coming, trying to visit me and trying to get me to crack, telling me that they had all these charges and blah, blah, blah. And I used that. At the time, I said, "Well, shit, if they think I'm doing this, I might as well do it." I use it as an excuse. It gave me an excuse. And, like, there is no excuse to get high. There never is. There's never an excuse to relapse. You can hear people say, like, "Oh, well, don't blame them for relapse." No, there's never an excuse to relapse, especially when you're putting so much work and you're doing well. But at the same time, I was lying to myself for that 6 months. I never put a backup plan in place. I never... You know, I had a good sober group of friends around me, people that supported me and everything, but I never opened up to anybody. I just kind of shut. I was like, "All right, well, I'm clean now, shutting that part of my life out. It's gone." And then after that, I was just like, "Well, I'm going to start getting high again." I did. And I was like wasn't a pretty regular thing. It just started like, it was like a weekend thing again until it evolved pretty bad, and then ended up costing me a good job I had. I was working at a ferry service in town here, and I was still using, and it ended up interfering with work, not showing up on time, missing call-ins, all that stuff. So I got fired from that job. Then the detectives just quit. They quit talking to me altogether. And they quit showing up, pulling me over at random times. If I was going 5 over the speed limit, they'd pull me over. It was like, and then like a cop would pull me over, or a Border Patrol agent would pull me over, and then a detective would show up. And they'd make me get in their vehicle and tell me I had to tell them all these things. And I would tell them, like, "Man, I'm not, you got, you know, like, you're wasting your time." And then, even if I had like someone in my vehicle that I didn't normally hang out with, they would pull me over and they'd literally say, "Oh, we just didn't recognize that guy. Just wondering who you're hanging out with now." Like, they'd do stuff like that. And it was like, it got to the point of where it was almost harassment. And then we ended up having a lawyer tell him that it was pretty much harassment. And that's when it stopped. And then I moved shortly after that. I figured, a geographical change is what would help me. And, in between, I guess I would say I'm about 24 now at that point, or about 23. And, I'm 30 now, just to give a scope on the timeline here. But so about 23 to 24, I started around the age of 24, I started using really heavy. And then I kind of weaned myself down, and I was using Suboxone I would get off the street to keep myself functioning and going to be able to go to work. And then occasionally I would go use my drug of choice. And then shortly after that, I moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is about 4 hours south of my hometown, and thinking that a geographical change would do it, you know, thinking that moving out of this area would help me out. And I did good. I was doing good down there for a little while, and it was just like one card off the stack, and I was back into the life. But this time I was in a bigger city with a much bigger drug and criminal element in the city, and it was easier for me to live that criminal life and still get away with it in the bigger city. And I just pretty much slid right into the underground and started using extremely heavy. Probably the worst I ever used in my life was down there. And this is about as bad as it got for me at the time, where I was just constantly running around. There wasn't a minute where I was sitting still unless I was incapacitated from using too much, and just running around the city, whatever I could cop, I would do it. Whatever I could grab, I would take it. Spending my day in parking garages looking for the next fix, go home at night and lie to my girlfriend at the time of whatever I was doing, and never having any money, and ended up having to live in the basement of her house for a little while because of this, and still doing the same thing. I don't know how edgy can I get, like, on the radio show?
You can speak freely.
Like, I was waking up with needles in my arm. I got woken up a few times by paramedics in a parking lot and sitting in the front seat of my truck. I went from work one night to a sports bar, got drunk, watching the hockey game, went up to my truck and got high. And when the police found me, I was parked in a turning lane, or I was in reverse in a turning lane, completely gone to the world, on going the wrong way on a one-way street about 2 miles in the wrong direction from my house. And they had to give me Narcan, and it just blew me awake. It just, like, all of a sudden I'm sober, I'm here. And then they bring me to the hospital, they do my blood test and everything, and they start writing up my charges, and like, well, we got to bring you to jail, but you're getting an OUI ticket, you'll be out, you know, within a few days, whatever. And they're like, you know, and the cops were giving me, like, all kinds of advice about treatment and all this stuff. The cops are really cool about it down there. It was pretty cool to see that. Looking back on that now, it was pretty nice. I didn't realize that actually till just now that they were actually willing to help, you know, that they were telling me, like, you know, you need treatment, man. There's plenty of good programs down here. And they're actually asking about me, which was really cool to see. Because up until then, I always had that idea that, you know, cops were not out to help us, especially the drug addicts. And then we get to the police station. This isn't one of my finest moments. And for some reason, when I was getting out of my truck, I was like, oh, I've got to have my hat. And I put my hat on. And we get to the police station. Well, I was in such a medicated stupor that I forgot that's where my entire stash was in my hat. So when they took my hat off me at the jail and they put it on the table, all these drugs fell out in the middle of the hat, and they're like, oh, well, what's that? So then they had to charge me. I almost got charged with smuggling contraband into a facility, but luckily enough, the cops were cool enough to be like, no, we should have searched them better. You can't, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, honestly, I was so messed up, guys. I did not know that was in there. And of course, they asked me, why didn't you tell us about it? I was like, why would I tell you about it? And so I got the possession charge. I got the OUI charge from that. And then about a week before that happened, I was working at a pizza joint, and I was using quite a bit and drinking quite a bit. I was a delivery guy, and I found out one of the managers was stealing my credit card tips, and I got, after work, I found out about it, and I got all wasted, and I went in there all crazy and started screaming at her and, you know, telling her she better pay me, blah, blah, blah. I was threatening her husband that worked there, and they kicked me out the front door, so I went in the employee door in the back, and I stole her. I kicked the door and snatched her purse, took all her money out of it, and threw her purse at her, and I said, call it even. Well, there, I should have just told the bosses on her, but in my mind, I was inebriated. I wasn't thinking straight. And there I am on camera threatening people and kicking doors and stealing money. And so after I got out of jail for the OUI and the possession, a week later, I get picked up on a warrant for that, for breaking and entry of a building, threatening, intimidating, and larceny of a building, and which all got dropped down just to the larceny, which was good because the woman actually ended up getting in trouble and spoke up for me, trying to save herself, saying that I was actually a good person and that blah, 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 that I wasn't in my right mind, which was nice of her. And then also at the same time, I had the OUI and possession charge. And so I'm still living in Grand Rapids at the time. And only about a week went by before I went right back to the same thing. And just cheating the system. Now I'm on probation. So now not only do I have to worry about getting high, making money, somehow trying to pay rent, but I have to worry about cheating the system at the same time, like fooling the probation officers. The job is 100% not to be fooled. And I had good luck at it at first, but I got careless, and then I started failing drug tests, and I started getting pulled over, and I started getting this and that. And then my probation officer just sat me down, and he said, listen, man, he's like, you got to figure out, like, you have nothing down here. He's like, I don't even know why you're still down here. There's nothing for you. He's like, I don't know if you're ever going to change, but you need to change something. And he's like, I'm transferring your probation back up to your hometown. So I was kind of bummed out about that, but I was really thankful that he did that. And so we set it all up, and I was bummed out that, you know, I was like, all right, well, now I really got to quit. But at the same time, I'm extremely thankful because I was like, he has a point. I really do have to quit. Like, I was the week before he told me this, I was literally breaking into drug dealers' houses and taking their stash, taking their money, and then calling them the next day, trying to keep a safe face, being like, oh, man, you know, oh, I don't know who did that. You know, and you got anything? You know, like trying to play dumb. Like, that's a very dangerous game, especially down there, because there are some real, those are some real gangster people down there that I was dealing with. And I mean, that was, you know, literally playing with the wrong end of a gun at some point. Mm-hmm. And, so I started my move back up north. I get up here, and the probation officer he signs me to says that I already have too many of your family members on my case. I cannot accept your probation. And she sent me back to Grand Rapids. So I had to move back down to Grand Rapids for a little bit. And then I just said, screw it, and moved all my stuff. I just said, no, I can't do it down here, because I was actually trying. I got on a medical assisted treatment program after that. And that was something that the probation officer told me. He's like, you have to do it. He's like, there's no other option for you. He's like, we can't get you into a rehab. You're not doing good on your own. Your outpatient's not working. He's like, you got to do something. And that was what we did. And it did help. I don't personally, for me or someone like me, I wouldn't recommend that, because a medical assistance program, even though there is, I mean, there can be success with it and it can be a good thing. But for me personally, it was just passing one off for the other. And it was just, you know, a matter of time before it wasn't enough. And just because that's the way I function. But I played that game for a little while. And then I just said, screw it, I can't live down in this basement anymore. I can't live this life anymore. So I just moved without either the probation officer's recommendations. I just moved back up north, and I pretended like I was still in Grand Rapids. So when I'd go meet the guy, I'd have to drive 4 hours to go report to my probation officer every 2 weeks. And then finally, I told him what I was doing, told him I was doing good. So he had the judge write an order saying that I had to, that's where I had to be located. And the probation officer accepted it. She was not happy about it. She still don't like me. And even after all these years of doing good and everything, she still doesn't like me. But so I moved back home. I'm on the medical assisted treatment program. I'm doing all right. And then finally I'm like, it just got to the point of like where I was using that as a crutch pretty much. And then I was drinking every night, and I was still breaking the law against my probation. I was never home. I was working at the time, didn't have a license. I was having friends drive me around in my vehicle and just like leave me places, like, yeah, pick me up later, whatever, take the vehicle. And then so finally I just weaned myself off of the Suboxone and again put myself in rehab, the same rehab, New Day up in Barrick, Michigan, which is a beautiful facility. It's a Native American ran facility, non-medical. It's a really nice place, and they use a lot of the traditional teachings for their program, which is awesome. It was the first time I did a sweat lodge. It was the first time I was in rehab there. And so I went up there 6 weeks, got out feeling better than I ever have. And then a month later, I decided that I was going to go party, and I drank for an entire weekend straight. And then Sunday evening, I woke up in the hospital being told that Sunday afternoon, I woke up in the hospital being told that I'd overdosed, and I had zero recollection of it. And it wasn't until like months later of people telling me like what had happened that I had finally pieced everything together. And I was downtown drinking, and I ran into a old using friend, and we started talking, and I ended up going back to his place with him. And he had told me one thing that he was giving me was another, and I ended up doing enough fentanyl to kill a person. I did enough fentanyl. I really shouldn't have survived, but I kind of remember doing the drug, and then kind of remember falling out, and then next thing I know, I'm being pushed through the doors of the ER, like coming out of it, and still on probation at the time too. And then the real eye opener for that was, because you asked like what was the eye opener, what was the gripping thing, was that it was going through them doors, waking up, them telling me like you were down to one heartbeat a minute for 5 minutes. The only reason you survived is because the police officer was giving me chest compressions. He was keeping me alive until the ambulance got there. He had to drag me out of a doorway. I was stuck in the doorway. He had to drag me out onto the street and wait for the ambulance to arrive. And he had pumped my chest so many times that he had bruised my lungs. I had got asphyxiated pneumonia from it and two broken ribs on both sides of my chest. And then when I started coming to in the hospital, I was in the room directly next door from my grandma, who was fighting for her life in the ICU at the time. And like my grandma had just went through a surgery, and then she went through a surgery, and then she broke her hip while she was recovering and had to get the other surgery. And then she had got, I believe she had got pneumonia, and that's what she was fighting at the end. And then there I am fighting for my life because I decided to get high. And my grandma's legitimately in the next room fighting for her life because she was just trying to live. And it was pretty, pretty intense. And, then a few of my friends stopped in, and just the looks on their face was enough to kill. I feel like that was, you know, that really, that just seeing the looks on their faces was, I can't explain it. It was like, it was like they were looking at me in my casket, pretty much. It was this the concern on their face. And then after that, I got out, and I was lucky enough that I didn't have to deal with the draws at the time, so I had a clear enough head after the clouds lifted from, you know, being without oxygen for that long and everything, and I started thinking clearly. And I had to go, well, pretty much answer for what I've done, because I just overdosed on felony probation, and it wasn't the first time I messed up on felony probation. So I had to go back down to Grand Rapids and go to court, and I ended up being put in Kent County Jail for sentenced to 180 days with the option of a sober living program somewhere in that 180 days that would, if I completed the sober living program, I would have been able to get out early. And it ended up shaving like 20 days off my time, which was nice. I really appreciated that. Because jail really does suck. And while I was in there, I was still kind of figuring things out. You know, I was still kind of coming to terms with the fact that I just, 2 weeks prior, I just died. I'm still getting over the broken ribs and the asphyxiated pneumonia in a jail cell in Kent County. And they're not providing me any treatment for any of it. And then after they had me in that jail cell, was medium security, so it was 20 hour lockdown, and you got, no, it was 21 hour lockdown. You got 1 hour out of your cell in the morning and 2 hours out of your cell at night. But the rest of that time was spent in you and another person in a pretty much like a 6x8 cell. And then after, I think it was like a month and a half, they just pulled me out and they put me in a sober living program, which was almost like it's like a rehab that you don't get to leave, and but you're still in jail. It's pretty, like, it was way more lenient, but the whole time I was in the other part of the jail, I was still doing street stuff. Like I was hustling drugs in there, and not like like sleeping medicine and stuff, because that's what people love to have, sleeping medicine when they're in jail, because that it helps them sleep. And I would buy it off people that had Seroquel, and I would, you know, I would sell it. And so I didn't realize, you know, like, I just, as soon as I got put back down in that element, I'm back down with all these people in Grand Rapids that I was on the streets with, and it just turned me back into that person. It didn't even click, you know. It's just being absorbed in that element. But then when I got switched over to the new cell, everything changed. It was a whole different thing. It was like I was back in rehab, and it was such a weight off my shoulders. We would, every morning for 2 hours, we had a group therapy, and then we had individual therapy for a half hour after that, and it went by name and by day or whatever. There was 16 people in our program. We were in a cell. It had a TV. It had two TVs. It had a vending machine, hot water, microwave. It wasn't like jail, and it was a good change. And it gave me a lot of really good tools for recovery, and it gave me a lot of insight on how other people view it too, like how people that don't realize they have a problem yet. And because it was like, I was stuck in a cell with these guys for 90 days. We're in rehab. You're in a house with people for maybe 90 days, but you're in a house. You can go outside. You can get away from these people. When you're in a cell with them, even if it's a big one, you still absorb all their energy, and you can pick up a lot. You can read them a lot better. And, and that's where I got my first taste of what a recovery coach was, because we'd have a recovery coach come in twice a month and talk to us. And I liked the guy a lot, but he was kind of arrogant about it because he'd been doing it for a long time. And he was like the type of person to say, like, I was an addict, but now I'm not, type of thing. And which kind of always rubbed me the wrong way, just like, because, I mean, once you're addicted, you're addicted. You can never go back to your drug of choice. You can't do it. And so did that for 90 days, got out around Thanksgiving, came straight back home. And right after I got out, my first child was born. And she was born December 8th, she's three years old, 2017, and or 2016 she was born, sorry. And I was there for her birth, got to see her, but then at the same time I had another kid being born in Colorado. And that's because that's the life I was leading before. I was just out doing whatever I wanted, and now it was finally time where I started feeling like inside I should start, you know, answering for what I've done, start doing the right thing. But at the time I didn't know what the right thing was, and so within a month of being out of jail for almost 180 days, I was already driving cross country to Colorado because my son was being born in a month or 2 months. And I got out there and I was doing good in Colorado. Now this is about, I got out of jail 2016 and now this is 2017. I'm living in Colorado, doing construction, doing all right. Son's born. Everything's good for a little while. And then it slowly started to turn again. And I think it was the wave of everything catching up with me. I didn't take enough time for myself to, like, you know, reprogram, rethink. Like, I was still, like, when I was driving to Colorado, I was still kind of in jail mode. Because when you live somewhere like jail or an institution for that long, you rewire yourself to accept that that's where you are and that's how things are. And that's just the way you have to live for a little while. And so 2017, I'm driving to Colorado or whatever. I'm already out there. I'm living, doing everything. And then I slowly start sinking back into the life. And I'm doing a great job at hiding it at first. But the girl, my son's mom at the time, was no stranger to my addiction. We'd been on and off in our relationship for years. And the only reason that we were ever, that we had ever had trouble was because of my addiction. It was always, my addiction always got in the way, and it was, and she just wouldn't have it. And so I did a really good job at hiding it for a while. And then as it started getting worse, started interfering with work, she started picking it up. And then I was at the point where I was like, all right, I think it's time for me just to start over, get help. And right as I started, and that was actually where the addiction was starting to take over, and it was starting to get real bad to where, like, I was going to be doing the same thing again, and I was starting to identify that. And then the federal government comes and picks me up on an extradition warrant from 2012, from when I started really doing, like, you know, where I really descended into the drug life, selling drugs and all that stuff, and picked me up an extradition warrant from 2012, and the only information that I had on it for the first few weeks I was incarcerated was that it was just an extradition warrant. They had no details on it. They had no details on who else was in the case. They had no details on the charges. And they picked me up within, I think it was 3 months of my statute of limitations. And at the time I was pretty butthurt about it. I was pretty upset. Like, I wasn't having it. But shortly thereafter I realized, I was like, this just pretty much saved my life. Like, I don't know. Like, I could have said that I was going to go get help, but I don't know if I would have. You know, I don't know if I was like, yeah, next week I'll go find a counselor. I'll go into rehab. But, I mean, just the week before that, I robbed a meth head for all of his money. I took all of his, told him I could get him some drugs, and I just took his money and left. You know, that guy could have killed me. The drugs I got with that money could have definitely killed me. There's no denying that. And then, so they shipped me to El Paso County Jail on the extradition warrant that I had no idea what was. The only thing they told me, they say it's out of Michigan. I was like, I haven't done anything in my hometown that would have a federal tag on it. And they're like, well, there's no statute of limitations on murder. So here I'm thinking for 2 weeks that I freaking killed somebody. And I'm like, oh, well, there goes me. And so they bring me back here because I had to go to court. Well, they brought me to a federal detention center in Colorado. I just stayed there for a little bit. And then they flew me back here to go to court because I had to go to court where I caught the charges at the federal court. And the judge, well, actually, so when I got my arraignment in Colorado, the judge, I finally found out that it was for delivery and manufacturing of a narcotic. I got three different buys, and It was a total of 5 different pain pills, and and the judge out there says, he's like, there's no reason you should be going to jail for or prison for any of this. He's like, if you had caught this charge, if you had picked this charge up in our county, we'd have you in a rehab program and on parole for a couple years. But he said, I don't know what Michigan's going to do to you. I do feel sorry for you, though. And then that was it. And then banged his gavel and sent me on my way and come back here. And they let me out for a couple months just because of my living situation and because of how old my crime was and my track record of not, like, when I'm not running from trouble, actually answering when I have legal trouble, I actually answer for it. So I go to Colorado, tie up all the loose ends, and then come back here for court, still 100% addicted. And they put me in federal holding while I was fighting my case. And that was this was 2017. December 6, 2017. That was my clean day. And, so they locked me up. And they transport me between the two holding facilities. One was in my hometown, and sat here for 10 months. And that's when I started realizing that was it. This is it. I can't, you know, because the jail up here is, I mean, all jails suck, but our jail up here is, it's no joke when it comes to doing time in this jail. It's like real torture. And I mean, I know there's worse places in the world, but it's not a fun place to be for almost a year. And then, so then fighting my case back and forth, had no idea what was going to happen. My original charges, I was looking at 6 years, and then they ended up giving me, after everything was said and done, was 18 months with time served, starting from when I first got arrested in Colorado. So then when they shipped me away to actual prison, I only ended up doing just under 5 months, close to like 4 months prison time. But they shipped me from here to Oklahoma City. I sat in Oklahoma City for a few weeks, and then from Oklahoma City to De La Rosa Prison in Texas, and then from there a few weeks, which was a medium security prison, it was like a Viking school, it was a place like a war zone. Then they put me in Big Springs, Texas, which was like a friggin' college campus with a fence around it that you couldn't leave. It was so relaxed. It was such a change of environment. It was like probably one of the biggest breaths of fresh air I ever had, even though it was like 110 degrees outside. It was nice. I hadn't seen sunlight since December 6th of 2018. And here I am. Yeah. Or 2017. I hadn't seen sunlight. And finally I get shipped out there. I'm in the desert, and I just kind of started going with the flow of things, but I was actually taking my life serious at this point. Like, I was thinking about what the next step was after this, because it was coming up fast. And I was talking to a lot of the people in there, and there's a lot of Native Americans in there that I was hanging out with. And most of them were doing, like, they had over 15 years left till they got out. And they're at a medium security prison, and they're like, this is the best life we can have for ourselves. And they're like, we don't have your option. And then, like, I would talk to them about, like, stuff I'd worry about, and they would just be like, listen, man, don't sweat the small stuff, bro. He's like, you're getting out. You got a chance. You got a chance to be a dad. You got a chance to live your life. Because I told them about my past, and, you know, they knew that I lived a wild life and that there's no reason I should be alive. And some of them lived the same life, and that's why they're there. But they were way less fortunate than me, you know. And it was just hearing their perspective on things. There's a guy in there with 30 years left, 15 years left out of a 30-year sentence, and he's just, I mean, I know he's got to have his problems, but he's just, you know, taking time out of his day to tell me to chill out, that things are going to be all right. Like, that's pretty humbling. It's, you know, it's pretty relieving. And just the experience of seeing, like, what prison was like and where I could be if I keep doing this. And it was almost like a Beyond Scared Straight program for just me as an adult. Like, it was like, wow, this can be You know, like I could adhere to this, but I don't want to. This is a wild life that I don't need to be living. And after I got out of there, it was just like a whole new me. And the cool thing was is that it sucked because they just kind of let me out and put me on a bus that I had to take all the way from Texas to Michigan, which is a 3-day bus ride. And that sucked because it was just, I just had the clothes I was wearing when I got arrested. And the little bit of property I picked up inside that I wanted to take with me. But I had a lot of time to think about what was next. I had a lot of time to, you know, like, really think about myself and what I was going to do. And then when I finally, actually funny, the bus left me in Memphis, Tennessee, and I had to wait there for a day, and I had to get another bus to Detroit, and then I had to have my dad pick me up in Detroit, and I thank the Creator every day for my parents. Like, my dad driving 5 hours to Detroit to pick me up from prison. But my dad's no stranger. My dad, he went to prison at a young age too and changed his life after he got out, ended up being a fairly successful. He ended up beating the odds. And my brother went to prison. So my dad understands it. He can sympathize and he gets it. He gets what it's like, you know, struggling with life and not knowing why. And I get back home and it was just like a whole new person. I just, the stuff that I worried about before just wasn't there. The rat race of life just didn't get to me like it used to. I'd actually take time to sit and smell the roses and, you know, actually had time to breathe for myself for once and think about myself. And then I realized that at that time it was, I had to live best life I could live for myself in order to be the best person I could for my family around me, my parents, my kids, my friends. I got a really solid group of friends that are like close as any sibling most people have. We've got a pretty big group of friends and we've all been friends for almost 20 years. And it's just, you know, they're, like I said, they're like my family. And me living my best life in a selfish way actually benefits them in the end, because I'm here, I'm still a friend, you know, like they don't want anything from me but to be that friend or that brother or that son or that parent. That's what they want. And if I didn't take my sobriety seriously and selfishly, then I wouldn't be able to do that. And that was October 2018. I got home. And ever since then, I've just, I've had jobs that everybody I've worked for says nothing but good things for me. I worked as a recovery coach for the better part of 2020. I had to resign because of the grant. There was a grant issue and the money was running out for our program. And at the time I had another job and a few of the people didn't. So it was going to come down to eliminating positions and I would have been one of the last ones to be eliminated. So I resigned from the recovery coach job, but, helping people and sharing where I've been and what I've been through has been a huge help in doing all this, especially when it came to being a recovery coach in my hometown. I've had so many people come up and ask me for help or advice on a loved one. And if I don't know the answer, I know people that do know, not the answer. There's no real answer, but I know people that can help them seek what they're seeking. Like, I've created a really good roster, a really good list of contacts that, you know, can help out. And there's actually a few people in my family, in my close family that are in the recovery community up here too, that, you know, that they can tell at the moment when something happens with me, then they'll look out for me. They'll like, hey, how you doing? You know, like, and that's another big thing too, is being open enough with the people that matter and having accountability to when they know that if something's going wrong, that they can see that change.
Well, I think that's great that you have that outlook on everything now and have gotten through that. I was going to ask you, you're part of the online group Sober Indians, and I wanted to know what is how do you feel about the group? Because when I look at it, I see a lot of supportive, loving, caring people on there, and I think it's great. So I wanted to know, basically, how has it helped you?
I'm very new to it, but I've only been a part of the group for the last few weeks. I've heard about it, but honestly, the online presence of the sobriety communities with like all the groups I'm a part of, it's cool because I mean I've seen people completely change their like people that haven't dealt with addiction and think it's just, you know, like something to be brushed off or that like addicts are a problem. I've seen people, them groups completely change people's outlooks on it. I've seen people that like, cause there are people out there in this day and age that can't go sit in a room full of people. They're too awkward or they're scared to open up. They can't go out there and do that. Like I can, or like the next person can. And they do have to reach out to like more anonymous sorts, like, you know, like a group, like a Zoom meeting or like a forum or a social media page, like a group on Facebook. They can reach out and they can just ask a question and have over 100 comments in the first 3 hours or 70-some comments, you know, within 30 minutes of asking the question. I feel like there's a lot of insight in there. But I would like people to know that you can't use somebody else's program for yourself. You can take things. You can see other things that people do and take that and add it to your tool bag. But you still have to create your own tool bag. And you have to find a way to keep your tools sharp and in good shape in order for them to work for you. But I think the online presence of recovery of the sobriety programs is awesome. I really do.
Yeah, me too. We're down to the last 3 minutes, and I wanted to say I really appreciate you coming on tonight and sharing your story with everybody. And I hope everybody out there that's listening, that someone took something from your story and really took it to heart and just know that, you know, someone needs help. There's always help out there, you know, if you're looking for it.
There is. Thank you so much for having me. And there is help, you know, no matter where you, just like when you're living the day-to-day drug life, you know, you would look anywhere to find what you needed. And when you're in sobriety and you need help. So look anywhere, look wherever you have to look to find it. You know, don't leave any stone unturned.
Absolutely. And thank you. Thank you again for coming on. I appreciate you speaking tonight and sharing your story with us. Hopefully, maybe a later date, maybe you can come back on and speak again if you want. And I wanted to tell everybody,
absolutely,
you know, thank you. Thank you. And thank you to everybody for tuning in and listening to us tonight. And have a great evening.
Thank you, Karen. You too. Don't get
You're
snowed
welcome.
Out.
I'm going to try not to. But you have a good weekend. Thank you.
Thank you.